Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And today we have a very special guest on our appellate podcast. Our guest is Dr. Jack Bass. And I'm going to give a little bit of my personal intro. About 20 years ago, I read this book when I was taking a class on the 14th Amendment in college. It's called Unlikely Heroes. And it was the story of the Fifth Circuit judges who really were kind of pushing through desegregation and voting rights and all in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education. It's a fantastic story and one that I think is particularly timely again today, unfortunately. A lot of the things that come up in the book are echoes of things that you hear today as people have to deal with civil rights issues even now into the 2020s. But the book really captivated me then, and it stuck with me all through law school. I read it again then, and then with all the things in the news, I wonder if Dr. Bass would be available and want to talk to us, and thankfully he was. And so our guest today is Dr. Jack Bass. Dr. Bass, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to what follows.
Kind of briefly, a lot of our listeners are lawyers, but I don't know that they necessarily have heard these stories or read the book. Could you just kind of tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you got interested in this topic and area?
Well, earlier I had gotten grants from the Ford and Rockefeller Foundation to do a book called Transformation of Southern Politics. This was, which came out in 1976, 5 years before Unlikely Heroes. One story or so out of that, you know, we went to all the states, former Confederate states, and spent a couple weeks, week or two in each of them, interviewing people all over the place. And one of the people in Arkansas was this 27-year-old lawyer who was just running unsuccessfully for a seat in Congress, and his name was William or Bill Clinton. So anyway, it was published by Simon & Schuster and got a bad review in the New York Times book review, and so they didn't give it any real push. But Unlikely Heroes developed later. And it developed from someone in Georgia who I think was, he knew Judge Tuttle well. And he had helped, he was also one of those who contributed to funding. He had an organization and they helped fund that first book. And so he's the one who got me started on it. And then I got grants again from all three of them. And then I had just run for Congress, which I was a terrible candidate, according to some people. But it was a very interesting experience. And I had a research assistant, Roy Pulvers, who's now a lawyer in Portland, Oregon. So he helped me with this book, and we ended up working out at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and we had an office there and wonderful help from the librarians and so forth in doing that kind of research. And there was also one member of the faculty who was particularly helpful. He came from, I think he was a Yale law graduate. So that was sort of our operating center when we were not on the road.
And just to context, you know, this book is about the Fifth Circuit, but at the time, I think you were writing it up till the end, a little bit before it came out. That actually covered, it went from El Paso all the way to Miami and
right.
Covered six out of the 13 or the six out of the 11 Confederate states. So it really was the Deep South was all within the Fifth Circuit.
Right. And then you had there were four judges who became, I think it was Ben Cameron referred to them as the four. Ben Cameron was from Mississippi, and I think he was really referring to the four horsemen of the apocalypse when he was talking about them. And so you had Judge Elbert Tuttle from Atlanta and Judge John Minor Wisdom from New Orleans. And the two of them had gone to the Republican National Convention. This was at the time when the South was all Democratic people who were not happy about Brown. That's sort of how we got started on it. And then you had Judge Richard Reeves from Alabama, who had been close to Hugo Black. I mean, Reeves went on to court. He had gone to Tulane for 1 year. He came from an old plantation family that lost everything in the Civil War. And he had read law, got his law degree, and this thing came up about possible Fifth Circuit. And he called Black to see if he thought he was really qualified to serve on the Fifth Circuit. Black simply told him, you can't do any harm. So he did. And then you had Judge John R. Brown of Texas, who grew up in Nebraska. Time of the, you had a senator there known as the Prairie Populist. So those were the ones that were came known as the four when they were attacked by Judge Benjamin Cameron from Mississippi as things went on.
The story really kind of starts with Brown versus Board of Education and the Warren Court's right. decisions, but these men were all appointed by President, well, I guess three of them were appointed by President Eisenhower, correct?
Right.
And then
part of that background includes Wisdom and Tuttle having gone to the Republican National Convention, as I said, and that's where they became. And then they got the full support of the Kennedy Justice Department while this was going on, and some excellent lawyers. And so they just took cases as they came along.
Judge Wisdom is a name that's known to us here in Texas because you mentioned he was from New Orleans, but the Fifth Circuit Courthouse in New Orleans bears his name. You walk through the doors of the John Minor Wisdom Courthouse when you go to the Fifth Circuit, and then Judge Brown, as you mentioned, was a Texan.
Right. No, that is all true.
When you and I were talking the other day, you had mentioned the story of how Earl Warren got his seat, and really it's kind of Earl Warren and the Warren Court that was the impetus for the desegregation decisions that formed the basis of the book. If you wouldn't mind, would you retell that story?
Sure. At that Republican National Convention, Warren was one of the candidates, and then he lost to Eisenhower. Eisenhower was putting together his cabinet later, and he turned to Herbert Brownell, and Brownell was played a key role in all of this, actually. They sort of filled up the cabinet, and he said, you know, we hadn't done anything for Earl Warren. And they had something like Secretary of Commerce left, that I guess you better call him. Brownell did, and he may have flown out there. Warren said, well, what he'd like to do is get on the seat on the Supreme Court. And then later, when the Chief Justice died, and think Brown, but in any event, that led to the opening, and Eisenhower said, you don't think he meant Chief Justice, do you? And said, I don't know. So he flew out there and talked to Warren, and Warren said, first vacancy is first vacancy. Eisenhower later thought it was the worst decision he'd ever made.
Well, and it definitely changed the course of history, and that's really kind of where your book picks up. They issued the Brown decision and Brown 2, and they did so in a way that really kind of left it up to the individual judges. They gave the all deliberate speed mandate, but then from your book, they really wanted to leave it to the judges in the South to figure out how exactly to implement that.
Right. And so then you had that remarkable group of judges on the Fifth Circuit.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry. And there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
One of the things that I liked about the book and the title, Unlikely Heroes, they really were sort of the unlikely group to South and enforce Brown's mandates over great public outcry. What about them? How did they kind of develop those views and change and step into those roles?
Well, I think Wisdom just had that position in terms of African Americans early. Once African Americans showed up at his door of his house, knocked on the door, and Wisdom came out, and the fellow said, I'm trying to figure out how to get to such and so street, which is like about 12 blocks away. And Wisdom just said, well, I tell you what, just you got the address? And he said, yeah. And he said, okay, well, just get in my car and I'll drive you there. Tuttle had a similar experience. I mean, it wasn't a similar experience, but a different experience when he was growing up, and he was only about 6 or 7 years old. Born in Hawaii, and then his parents ended up moving to Washington. He was sitting on the porch with his mother when he was about 7, and this African-American woman was waiting for the next trolley car to pass, come by if she wanted to get a ride. One just went right past her. Second one went right just past her. His mother got up, walked across the street, stood beside her, and the next one stopped, and she just came back to the porch. And he just observed it all, but it made an important impact on him. Reeves grew up in Montgomery, and he'd been on the three-judge court with Frank Johnson, Judge Frank Johnson, when took three tries to get Johnson to get a three-judge district court. And this was for the Montgomery bus boycott that launched the career of Martin Luther King. And so he had a three-judge court, and they ended up voting 2-1 in favor of to end the boycott. So that really, I think, set off King's career right there. Did we leave out anybody?
Just Brown.
Yeah, Brown was born in, he was from Texas, but he grew up in Nebraska. So Brown had probably spoke the loudest of any of them when he was on the court.
He was well known in law school circles for the opinions that he wrote, which, you know, outside of the civil rights context were very colorful and clever. And I understand that sort of matched his personality as well.
Yeah, that's very true.
You mentioned the three-judge courts. And for those of us that practice in the Fifth Circuit, you know, they do sit in three-judge panels, but this was something a little bit different. This was three judges, meaning three district judges or a combination of district judges and circuit judges that would sit and hear these cases, these civil rights cases in the South, not necessarily an appeal to a three-judge panel on the Fifth Circuit, right?
Right.
And that's something that throughout the book you talk about, and it really was interesting because those procedures still exist, but they're hardly ever used in litigation now. It's just not something that we see as much. But that really was one of the main ways that they were able to move these segregation or the desegregation decisions through the South was through these three-judge courts.
Yeah, I think that's true. And most of the time you had two members of the appeals court, district judge.
And the Fifth Circuit four judges, particularly the ones that were chiefs at the time, had a big role in picking who was going to sit on those various courts, correct?
Correct.
Some of that is kind of what led to, I think you'd mentioned Judge Cameron, to some backlash with Judge Cameron.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? You know, he kind of took some unprecedented steps as a Fifth Circuit judge to sort of air the court's private laundry and create some issues through all that.
Cameron was essentially a defender of segregation. I mean, he would do what he could to block anything that was going to make huge changes in Mississippi in terms of race and racial equality.
When he was on the court, I know that there was an opinion where he really, in his dissent, laid out a lot of the court's sort of private laundry, so to speak, about the way that they assign cases to the three-judge panels and his opinion that he thought that that changed the outcomes in cases and really took public a fight that I think today would be pretty shocking to most of us who practice in the Fifth Circuit, putting a lot of that private stuff out there. I know that took up a chapter of your book, and I thought that was pretty interesting to see just how nasty that fight got internally in a court.
No, and particularly if it involved the state of Mississippi, in particular the time James Meredith entered Ole Miss.
The three-judge courts were part of what forced that decision through, the desegregation of the University of Mississippi, and these Fifth Circuit judges in particular.
Right. And then you had some lawyers from the Justice Department were involved in this sort of thing. I mean, some really top lawyers.
And
I was just going to say, and, you know, they were, I mean, you know, at least one of them at one step, you know, in front of a mob and so forth. But you put it all together, you really had a powerful force running against a strongly powerful opposition in most of those states.
You know, the Fifth Circuit Four, you talk several times in your book about some of the personal backlash that they faced as a result of the jobs that they did.
Yeah, now I'd say it was particularly in Montgomery with Judge Reeves. I mean, Judge Reeves regularly went to his Presbyterian church, and after he went on the court and first opinions, nobody would sit next to him. The others usually had their own set of friends. They would get calls at night. All of them would be getting calls at night from people screaming at them. Judge Sutter would leave the phone off the hook at about 11 o'clock at night.
I was going to ask if they had any threats to their physical safety.
Actually, Frank Johnson probably had more than anyone during that time. I mean, I later wrote his biography, too, that all happened by accident. Jacqueline Onassis was my editor, and I asked her once how she got interested in Frank Johnson. She said, she kind of looked up and said, I guess it goes back to hearing Jack and Bobby talk about him.
Wow. So you actually got the book idea to talk about Judge Johnson from Jacqueline Onassis?
Casually mentions Jacqueline Onassis.
And yeah.
It's no big deal at all.
You surprised us with that name.
Now, what happened on that book, I was in teaching at Ole Miss. They had a first-rate editor, former New York Times person, at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they had a magazine at that. And this was when there was going to be a big meeting in Alabama on the 25th anniversary or whatever it was of George Wallace's stand in the schoolhouse door. And I wanted to go and was trying to figure out how I could get the money to pay for a round-trip flight. And so someone said, why don't you do an article for the magazine? And I was going to do one on how history will look at George Wallace. And I called John Hope Franklin, and I called a couple of other major Southern historians, mostly from Ivy League schools. And then I decided I'd just call Frank Johnson and ask him. He said, well, you just don't know. You just don't know. I hadn't planned to say it anything. I said, you know, Judge, I might be interested in writing your biography one day. And he said, well, I wish you would. So that's how that all happened. Then when I interviewed him for the first time, he said, now who's going to edit this book? And I said, I don't know. And I said, you know, I had Alice Mayhew at Simon & Schuster, but I don't think she'd be interested. And he said, Jacqueline Onassis would like to edit this book. That's how it all happened.
Wow.
So I called my agent in Washington, and as you may know, that's the book that Durbin gives to every new justice when they're inaugurated.
At the time of all this, Judge Johnson was on the district court, but he would later go on to be part of the Fifth Circuit as well.
Correct.
And you do devote a substantial amount in your book to him, and he really was kind of one of the frontline people that pushed this through in very deeply segregated state at great, great personal cost.
True.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that again, I think would surprise people today is one of the things the Fifth Circuit did after they realized how much obstruction was going on from the states and sometimes in the district courts was just simply come up with their own injunctions and then force the district courts to order them to do whatever it was, which is something that I think would be shocking to see out of the Fifth Circuit these days.
Yes, they were very creative judges, and their clear objective was making a ruling to make sure that it was enforced.
It seems like the level of enforcement they got sort of ebbed and flowed depending on which administration was in office.
Yeah, there was some truth in that.
You know, it was interesting, I think, to see the differences between the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations, and then, of course, later the Nixon administration.
Right. The Nixon administration was obviously the worst by far, but the Kennedy and Johnson administrations gave them full support, and they had people in the Justice Department, very good lawyers from the Justice Department involved in a lot of those cases.
One of the themes that kind of struck me throughout the book here that I don't really think about practicing now, but in so many of these states, they couldn't find lawyers who would take civil rights cases. They just simply wouldn't represent them for whatever reason, whether it was a belief that they were wrong or just fear of public retribution. But
yeah, I think it was mostly the latter.
Mm.
They'd quit getting clients.
Any of these were prosecuted either by CP, those types of groups, rather than the local lawyers who just refused to be part of it.
Right. And you had some lawyers from the North came down and they worked on those cases.
One other kind of specific topic I wanted to cover with you that I thought was interesting. We'd mentioned the Meredith desegregation of the University of Mississippi, but that actually led to a long multi-year process where the court actually was going to hold Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi in contempt. The Fifth Circuit was, which is something that, again, is just sort of a shocking thing to those of us who practice in the Fifth Circuit today, the idea of a circuit court holding a state governor in contempt, potentially even sending him to jail over all this. Can you talk a little bit about that episode?
Yeah, that was when James Meredith became the first black applicant at Ole Miss, and it took a year for him to get enrolled in college. And then there was a huge riot on campus. And then you had the governor of Mississippi very resistant to anything the court did. And I believe I'm correct that they then threatened to hold him in contempt. And finally, you ended up with the Justice Department very much involved in it. In fact, it took more than a year for him to actually become a student there. But that really broke the color line in Mississippi.
The thing that I thought was interesting about the whole contempt proceeding was it went forward and went forward, and nobody was willing to bend until they told the trustees of the University of Mississippi that they might go to jail, and then all of a sudden they all backed
right
down and told Governor Barnett that they weren't going to back him anymore on that.
Right. In one sense, that was sort of one of the more, I'm not sure what the term is. It's more than just interesting case, but one of the most powerful cases, I think, in the book.
It really was, because it sort of, it was almost kind of a high watermark of federalism and the federal court's ability to intervene over state subjections to make sure that the 14th and 15th Amendments were enforced in the South.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
One other area, you know, we've talked about desegregation, but another area where the court had a lot of power and really made a huge impact was in voting rights cases.
Yes.
And, you know, what were some of the things that everybody had the right to vote?
I mean, that was the basis of it all. And that's where, and particularly in those cases, that's when you began, I think probably when you had the maximum amount, at least, of assistance from the Justice Department arguing those cases.
It seems like from your book and, you know, just kind of civil rights history in general, some of those cases spawned just some of the absolute worst incidents and atrocities that happened in the South. The retribution against people that came in to help register voters and people that tried to make sure that the right to vote was there. And so it's amazing how much impact
right.
the court was able to have.
I remember at one point, this was after trying to take the senator's name from Mississippi.
Senator Eastland.
Senator Eastland of Mississippi. I think he had just retired at that time. So I called him once, told him about what I was working on a book and would like to talk to him. And so he said, well, he invited me to come over. And this was the time those freedom riders were, or whatever group it was, one of those groups coming into the South to try and register voters. He was saying, they better stay off my land or something like that. I said, well, Senator, you know what? I said, you know, you got a lot of black people live on your land you own, and if they get registered to vote, they'll all vote for you. He said, you know what? That's a good idea, which he did. But Eastland was quite a character.
Yeah, he really is kind of one of the, I guess if you had to call him an antagonist, one of the main antagonists in the book, who was very pro-segregation and pro-states' rights and status quo, and did a lot to kind of resist what was going on.
Yeah, one thing I think that's not in the book is riding me around is all this land, and pulled his car over to the side of the road and got out to urinate in the middle of the road and came back. Like, I own it all.
It sounds like an LBJ type character.
Well, I think he went a step further.
Oh, wow.
But the support we got from the University of South Carolina School of Law was very, very helpful. And after we finished all the research, then I had a small little cabin at North Myrtle Beach. It was on a little stream, you know, a little feeding into the Atlantic. And so my research assistant and I, we went there, and that's where I actually wrote it.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages, from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
One thing that I think is so vivid about these stories is so much of it was based on your personal interviews with all the people involved, from the judges, the lawyers, the senators. You just, it's amazing to kind of hear firsthand some things that I think had never really been put on paper about the decisions and the impact that the court had.
I think that's true.
I'm wondering if a book like this could be written today. You had so much access, even though you were covering a lot of territory. It seems like you had a lot of access to the judges. And I just am trying to imagine what that would be like today.
I don't think it would happen.
You think about what might be something approximating this level, and just in terms of your amount of litigation. We had a lot of Texas prison conditions litigation here in Texas that was presided over by a federal district judge for something like 20 years. And this to me brings that same thing to mind. It's like that sort of scale of, as you say, the Justice Department having to get involved to try and implement these mandates that here came down from the U.S. Supreme Court. It's hard to imagine something on this scale taking place today, especially in our climate.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more.
One of the things that you said in the book, and I don't remember who the quote was attributed to, but the gist of it was these four judges and their work on the Fifth Circuit really brought about desegregation and voting rights in the South probably a decade or more earlier than the Supreme Court could have done, and if they'd been the ones to try and handle it.
Yeah, I believe that was from someone in the Justice Department who spent a fair amount of time down there.
It really is amazing.
I'm trying to remember who, too. No, nothing like that would be going on now from this administration.
Well,
say the current head of the Justice Department.
Today, I think the word judicial activist is one that a lot of people view negatively, but it seems like at the time, certainly Judge Wisdom and maybe some of these other judges really wore it as a badge of honor. That was what they had to do to force the South to take up the mandates of the Supreme Court and enforce the Constitution.
I mean, they really were a remarkable set of judges that somebody, if they were writing it and trying to express it, might just say, you know, it was an act of God that they got on there.
It really is. But, when you think about the scope of the social change that happened over what was essentially about two decades. I know that it started a little earlier and ended a little bit later, but really was kind of hot and heavy for about two decades. It's amazing that they sort of reformed the South, and certainly they had plenty of people helping them. I don't mean to minimize the roles of many people that had so many important things to do with the civil rights movement, but just from the judicial perspective, they really did kind of blaze a new path that I think would be unfamiliar to so many of us that practice in federal courts today.
No, and if you look at, you know, at public schools today, my opinion, but it's based on at least a degree of factual knowledge, that the South is Southern schools are far more integrated than those in the North. And part of that began when the Supreme Court began changing, and sort of Detroit played a major issue in all of that. The Supreme Court's opinions after local district judges had moved to integrate the schools from North Carolina, when you had the initial order by the Judge McMillan in Charlotte to have the same percentage of blacks and white in every school. And then it later got just knocked down. But I say the only thing we know is constant in life is change.
That's true. That kind of brings up the ending of the book. You end your tale in the early 1980s, right, when it came out, which is at the time that the Fifth Circuit kind of underwent a huge transformation between judges that had been appointed in the late 60s and early 70s from the Nixon administration having an impact on it, and from the split up of the circuit, it really dramatically changed the character and the size of that docket.
Very much so it did. Now, of course, you've got the Albert P. Tuttle Federal Courthouse in Atlanta and the Frank M. Johnson Courthouse in Montgomery and the John Minor Wisdom Courthouse in New Orleans, and I think there's another one somewhere. So the imprint on history will live on.
I think you're right. You know, the story and the period of time that this covers really is one that, number one, hopefully couldn't happen again, given the things that went on, but also wouldn't happen again with the way that the courts are set up and the way that the the branches interact with one another. It really was a remarkable time from a perspective of how courts enforce the Constitution in these kind of unique situations.
You know, when Judge Tuttle died, I was actually spending a semester teaching in France. I told my wife, I've just got to fly back for the funeral.
Did you?
I did. I think my favorite possession that I have is I've got a gavel that Judge Frank Johnson did by hand. And on the very small end of it at the back, it just has FMJ on it.
Wow.
It's on my mantelpiece in the living room.
That's amazing. It really is amazing to kind of think about and remember the personal dimension that goes into judging. Because so often, especially those of us that practice in these courts, you know, you forget that everybody making those decisions is human, and those decisions have outsized impacts both on the people who make them and the people who are arguing and have to live with them. And I think that this book really, the first time I read it, really drove that home for me, is, you know, the personal nature and stake that judges have in cases and how much it impacts them.
Clearly impacted you too, Dr. Bass.
It did.
We want to be respectful of your time, and we really, really appreciate you coming and joining us to share these stories today and kind of share your own reminiscences and experiences with that. I think that this is an important story that doesn't get told nearly enough, because it's one that I think people kind of forget about when you're talking about all these events, that the court did have a big role, particularly the Fifth Circuit.
All right. Well, I think that covers it. Am I correct?
You're correct, and we really appreciate you being here. We'll go ahead and wrap up and let you go.
All right. Well, I enjoyed it too. So,
thank you, Dr. Bass.
Have a good rest of the day.
You too.
You too.
All right.
Before we go, we'd like to pause for just a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support, and we also appreciate the support of everyone listening to the show. Thank you for listening.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would really be great too. Thank you, everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.